Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, my boyfriend and I don't live together. If you saw my house, which looks like a used bookstore with an oven, to borrow somebody's tweet I once saw, you'd understand why. Now, this means that we spend a good bit of our time together on the phone and on Skype. And sometimes the phone will ring and you'll be in the middle of something, but you also don't want to hang up. And when I say you, I mean me. And apparently I say just a second or 1 second or wait, or can you wait a second, quite a bit. I didn't realize this, that is, until my large Detroit ornery boyfriend said, if you say that again, I'll scream like a little girl. Okay. Suddenly I see myself in one of the points my guest tonight, investigative journalist Charles Duhigg, makes. And that's that we spend much of our life on autopilot. Realizing that and looking for our automatic behavior so we can change this is just one small part of tonight's show, which actually isn't just a show, but a shovel to help you dig out of your bad habits. And it'll also help you start and keep up new ones, new good ones, that is. So let's welcome my guest tonight, investigative science journalist Charles Duhigg, who lays out the science on habit formation and eradication in this very helpful book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Hello, Charles.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, I love your book. I'm so glad you're here. I even mentioned it in my column. And now let's talk about where this all started. You had been in Iraq for about 2 months when you heard about an officer, a major, who was conducting an impromptu habit modification program.
Yeah, that's right. So I had just graduated from business school and became a journalist. And one of the first things that I did is that I got sent to Iraq, which was very exciting for me as a young reporter. And I got off the plane and I realized that basically I had no idea how to be a reporter in a war zone. And so I was talking to my colleagues and I was asking them kind of, how do I do this job? And they said, well, the first thing you should do is try and find stories where you can report them indoors, because that way, even if someone's shooting at you, there's these like nice thick walls between you and the bullets. And so so I was sort of prospecting around and I got embedded with the military and went down to this base in a city named Kufa, which is about an hour south of Baghdad by air or by helicopter. And I went down there, and one of the reasons I was kind of interested about it was because I learned when I got there that they had just posted this new major to the region. And he had been given this explicit assignment, which was to stop riots from happening. So he had, as he told me once I got down there, he'd gone and he met with the mayor of Kufa, and they'd sort of had this like long conversation, and the major had this like whole laundry list of things that he asked the mayor to do, like, you know, stop the gun runners and stop suicide bombers. And the mayor was like, look, I can't do any of that stuff. I mean, I'm like trying to like just keep track of stuff. And eventually, one of the issues was that in Kufa, they had a whole bunch of riots. Riots had been happening regularly. They were really deadly. And so the major sort of had this one item left on his list. And he said, well, look, I'll tell you what, can you get the food vendors out of the plazas? And the mayor says, sure, like this one I can do. I'll take the food vendors out of the plazas, whatever. If you want that, then it's all yours. So a couple of weeks later, there's this crowd that starts showing up around the Grand Mosque of Kufa, which is this very important site in Shia Islam. And the thing that they never tell you on the news is that it actually takes a number of hours for a riot to develop. So what often happens is that like troublemakers will show up, and then some spectators come to watch the troublemakers, and then more spectators come to watch the spectators, and the crowd will get larger and larger and larger until it reaches a size that kind of is this like magic tipping point where it's big enough that when someone throws a bottle or a rock, a riot breaks out and people end up getting injured. And so these troublemakers show up by the Grand Mosque of Kufa, and some spectators show up to watch the troublemakers, and the crowd starts getting larger and larger, And it's getting big enough that they actually radio the local base, the town authorities, and ask them to be on standby because they think a riot's going to break out. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and you get to about like 5:30 or 5:45 in the evening, and the crowd is now a sufficient enough size that a riot could occur. But it's 5:30 or 5:45, right? It's like evening time. It's when people usually would have dinner. And so the people at the periphery of the crowd, they're looking around for these kebab vendors that usually sell food in the plaza near the Grand Mosque of Kufa. But, of course, the mayor has removed all the food vendors from these areas at the army's request. And so people at the periphery of the crowd, they basically get kind of hungry, and they just start wandering home to go have dinner. And there's like another ring of people, you know, of spectators, and they see these folks leaving, and they think to themselves, oh, there must be a better riot going on someplace else. So they kind of wander off too. And over about like half an hour, 45 minutes, the crowd really thins out in this plaza. And it gets thinned out enough, in fact, that everyone who's remaining, they just decide to kind of go home too, because it doesn't seem like there's anything going on. And once all the spectators leave, the troublemakers are still there, but they don't have an audience anymore. And so they decide to go home too. And there hadn't been any major riots in the city of Kufa since the army major had arrived and had made this change. And so I went and I asked him about this, and I said, you know, how did you know that this was going to have this impact? And there were a number of things that they had done, but this was the one that kind of everyone was talking about or that he seemed particularly proud of. And he said, look, I didn't know that, you know, removing the food vendors would have much of an impact, right? We tried a bunch of different stuff. But he said that when he got into the military, one of the things he realized pretty quickly, and this is, you know, years and years earlier, is that the military is this giant habit change machine, right? And this is actually right. A lot of what we know, a lot of the research has been done on the neurology of habit formation and the psychology of it comes from the military. Because when you think about it, you know, our natural instinct when someone is shooting at us is to run the other direction. But the army teaches soldiers these habits to shoot back. Or because now you can email your spouse or sometimes call them from a war zone every night, the army has to teach you good communication habits, because if you get into a fight with your wife or your husband over email, and then you're distracted when you're on patrol the next day. And so the military thinks really, really hard about how to influence soldiers' habits. It teaches them how to think about habits. And the army major said that when he was introduced to this kind of training, that it really changed everything about how he saw the world. He said that he used this stuff in kind of, you know, training his troops, but more importantly, as importantly, in how he and his wife communicated, how they raised their kids. He said it was like someone had given him like these habit-tinged glasses, and that once he put them on, everything in the world seemed kind of different, including how a huge crowd of Iraqis might respond to, you know, changes in their environment. And so I thought that was really, really interesting.
What was the analysis of that in terms of habits? What did this tell you about habits?
Well, So when I heard that story, I didn't really know much about the science of habits yet. What it told me is that habits are interesting, right? That they seem like they should be malleable. And so when I came back to the U.S., I started talking to neurologists and psychologists and other folks about this stuff. And that's where I really began to learn about the habit loop, right, which is this kind of fundamental building block in our understanding of how habits function, but also in how habits form within our brains. And what the habit loop says is that every habit has three components. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for an automatic behavior to start, and then a routine, which is the behavior itself, and then finally a reward. And the reward is how your brain learns to remember that pattern for the future. And we've basically known this since Pavlov, right? That the cues and rewards and the importance of kind of conditioning. But what we've really learned in the last decade, and we're living through kind of this golden age of understanding the neurology of habits right now, what we've learned in the last decade is just how powerful those cues and particularly rewards can be. That if you can diagnose and start playing with how cues and rewards influence our behavior, you can basically change any habit. So most of what I've learned about habits has really come from doing reporting with neurologists. And a large portion of that is actually based on sort of our understanding of habits, on the environmental cues and rewards that change people's behavior. So Eugene Pauly is this really interesting figure, and he's kind of seminal in our understanding of how habits function. In medical literature, he was known as EP, and his identity was kind of shrouded through most of his life. So Eugene Pauly is this guy who one day has a little bit of a fever, and he starts acting kind of oddly. And so his wife, they're living in California, she takes him to the hospital. And in the hospital, he develops a very, very high fever and slips into a coma. And when the doctors try and figure out what's going on and they take a sample of his spinal fluid, what they realize is that he's contracted viral encephalitis in his brain. Now, viral encephalitis is the same virus that causes cold sores on our lips. It's a relatively benign virus in most situations. But in a very, very small number of cases, it can get into our spinal fluid and it travels up into our brain. And in our brain, it kind of begins to consume brain tissue with this almost like surgical precision. And so they pumped Eugene Pauly full of drugs to kill the virus. They ended up succeeding in doing so. But the damage that had been done was permanent. It couldn't be undone. And what the virus had done is it had chewed up a portion of his brain that's tied to memory. So when he finally came out of this coma and recovered, he had essentially lost the ability completely to form new thoughts. If he met you, he would remember your name for a couple of seconds, and then he would have no idea who you were. And he had lost all of his memories from about 1960 on. So he could remember things, for instance, JFK getting elected. But then after that, it got fuzzy, and then at some point his memories just entirely cut out. So he would meet his grandchildren and have no idea who they are, and then meet them again and still not remember who they are, not remember meeting them before. He thought that he was about 15 years younger than he really was because he had no sense of memory of the passing years. And as you can imagine, this is really disturbing for both Pauly and for his wife. He essentially became a complete amnesiac because of the damage that had been done to his brain. But what's really interesting is he couldn't learn new behaviors because he couldn't remember anything he learned. But what researchers discovered is that he was able to still form new habits. So one of my favorite examples of this is that there was this neurologist who would go over to his house, and he would ask Pauly to draw him a map of his house, right? You know, he'd draw a picture of the living room, like which door goes to the kitchen. And EP would say, I have no idea. I mean, he couldn't do it. He couldn't draw a map. He had no idea which door led to the kitchen or to his bedroom. And because he couldn't form any new memories. And they'd be sitting there, and the doctor would be entering this information into the computer and giving them this test. And then Eugene Pauly would say, I have to go to the bathroom. And he would stand up, and he would walk across the living room into the bathroom, go to the bathroom, wash his hands, come back out, and come sit down again. And if the doctor asked him, what door out of this room leads to the bathroom? Eugene Pauly couldn't tell him. He had no memory of where the bathroom was, but he had learned a habit, this habitual behavior of finding the bathroom. And so as a result, he knew how to do that. He just didn't know that he knew how to do that.
Yeah, that is so remarkable. And researchers suspect that the brain's basal ganglia has something to do with this, with habit formation. And actually, I remember the basal ganglia as our action selection department. I don't know how you think of them. But tell us a little bit about the relation to basal ganglia and how that related to what Eugene Pauly was doing and experiencing.
Well, that's exactly right. So the basal ganglia is sort of this a really old part of the brain, right? Almost every animal on Earth that has a brain has a basal ganglia. And what it seems to do is it seems to be a structure that is separate and distinct from memory and separate and distinct from the prefrontal cortex where we make decisions. And what the basal ganglia does is it helps us create associations between certain behaviors and certain cues and rewards, right? So that's why we're able to form habits. What happens is that if you encounter a cue, like, needing to go to the bathroom, and you associate it with a certain behavior. I stand up, I walk across the room in a certain direction, I open the door, and there's the toilet. And there's also a reward there, right, which is that I feel this sort of relief of tension because I'm able to go to the bathroom. The basal ganglia takes that pattern, if it happens frequently enough, and it helps your brain form a connection between that cue and that routine and that reward. And then, as a result, neural pathways grow that connect those three things, and the behavior becomes more and more automatic. So at some point, whenever you need to go to the bathroom, you'll just automatically stand up and start walking across the living room, because your brain knows that that cue and that behavior are associated with a reward, which is that you can find the toilet. Similarly, I think we've all had this experience when we, when you're like at work and you've already had breakfast and so you're not really that hungry, and you walk past the break room and you see a box of donuts, and suddenly you'll begin craving the donut, right? Like 5 seconds earlier, you weren't hungry, but now that your brain has seen the donuts, you begin craving a donut, and that craving basically doesn't go away until you walk over and pick up a donut or just decide to start ignoring it. That's also a habit, right? Because what's happening there is that the cue is a visual stimuli of seeing the donut that reminds your brain, and I'm using these words kind of parochially because it's not really being reminded, but that's an easy way to think about it. That cue of seeing the donut sort of reminds your brain of the reward of eating a donut, which is super yummy and it's got sugar and your brain loves that stuff. And so when you get reminded of that reward, it develops this craving to go over and pick up the donut. So you can find yourself unthinkingly walking over, picking up a donut, and eating it. And that's because a habit has emerged.
This is so interesting. And I want to go back to something that you were talking about, this whole bathroom visit thing of Eugene Pauly, the compounding of all those actions. This is something we talked about called chunking on my show with Dr. Barbara Oakley, and it's the way the brain converts this sequence of actions or information to this compilation so you can draw upon it without having to figure out all that stuff, because our brain, it's just, it would be so intense if every time, or the description I like to give, every time you got to a door that you had to look at it and think, what is that round thing there? That looks like maybe you could grab that. You don't do that. You just, you turn the knob, you go in, you don't have to think about it. So tell us a little bit about chunking vis-a-vis habits.
Well, so chunking and habit are very similar, right? So chunking is kind of a necessary prerequisite and step in developing a habit. And you're exactly right. Our brain basically wants to turn any regular pattern into a habit. And studies indicate that about 40 to 45% of what we do every single day is a habit, that it's not really a decision, it's something that happens automatically. And the reason your brain loves habits, wants to create, turn things into habits, is because your brain is constantly looking for ways to save or conserve energy. Right, to your point, if you had to like figure out how a door worked every single time you walked up to one, or if you had to remember how to walk every single time you stood up, then you wouldn't really have enough mental bandwidth to do other things, like thinking about the meeting that's coming up today, or invent fire, or program video games. So one of the things that our brain does, and all brains do, is it tries to figure out how to conserve energy as much as possible so that we can reallocate our brain's work to higher and more important tasks. And so as a result, any regular pattern in your life will become a habit if you don't consciously intervene.
I just wanted to bring up your caveat. You say, and I'll quote you, conserving mental energy is tricky because if our brains power down at the wrong moment, we might fail to notice something important, such as a predator hiding in the bushes or a speeding car as we pull onto the street. And so you say that our basal ganglia have devised this clever system to determine when to let our habits take over. So explain that.
Right. Well, so those are cues, right? So one of the things that happens is that our brain essentially sort of says to itself, "Look, I don't know when to let sort of automatic behaviors take over. I don't know when to let you stop paying attention. So one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to look for cues that tell me, should I go into automatic mode or should I go into like high awareness mode? So for instance, if I'm a mouse that's, you know, stuck in a, or it's in a dark place, I don't know if there's chocolate outside or a cat outside. And so what I'll do is I'll look for cues. If I can smell chocolate, I'll behave one way. If I hear a cat, I'll behave another way. And I'll do that almost automatically. And so that's why cues are so important, is because cues are our brain's way of deciding when it has to pay attention or when it can let an automatic pattern take over.
Yeah, that's so important. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is investigative journalist Charles Duhigg, and his book is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, and I really recommend it because it's very helpful. This is something very important to note. You write that the cue and the reward become intertwined until a very powerful sense of anticipation and craving merges, and then eventually a habit is born. So take us back just to review what the cue, routine, and reward are, and then tell us about that, how the cue and reward become intertwined.
Well, so the cue is like the trigger for an automatic behavior to start, and then there's the behavior itself, and then a reward. And that reward is why your brain remembers that pattern for the future, right? Because it wants that reward. And craving is essentially the driving force that allows that loop, that habit, to sort of start spinning. So to go back to the donut example, you know, the reason why we have this instinct to go over and pick up a donut when we see them sitting on a box or see a box of them sitting on the table is because our brain remembers what it's like to eat a donut, right? And eating a donut is kind of awesome. You get this burst of sugar. You get a lot of taste receptacles that sort of go crazy with pleasure because they're being exposed to fat. And so there's a lot of rewards associated with a donut. And so as long as there's nothing about a Dunkin' Donuts box that in a state of nature would inspire anyone to crave like some round thing inside of it, right? It's a learned behavior. You have to eat a couple of donuts to understand that you should like donuts because they taste good. But this is really important. This is how our brain actually functions for the most part. Is it learns things all the time. And it tends to learn things by assuming sort of a proximity or a causation, which may or may not be true. Now, in the case of donuts, it is true, right? If you see a box of donuts, a Dunkin' Donuts box, there's a pretty good chance that if you open it up, it'll contain a donut, and that if you eat that donut, it'll have sugar all over it, and it'll taste super yummy. But what's important here is that your brain doesn't distinguish really, really strongly between what are good habits and what are bad habits. In fact, your brain, there is no such thing as a good habit or a bad habit. There's just patterns that you learn and that you replicate because the sense of craving drives you to a behavior that's rewarded you in the past.
Let me just ask you, you just brought up what I was going to ask. So there's some reward, and this reward doesn't necessarily have to be, as you were saying, good. It just has to be something that comes out, something that meets some goal we are going after. It may not be, so maybe we're going to have a cigarette. That's not positive on one level, but on another level it is.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily need to meet a goal as much as it needs to provide something that some part of our brain thinks is good. So cigarettes are a great example, right? Because I think many people who smoke will tell you that cigarettes don't actually taste very good, and that they don't like the smell of cigarettes, and they don't like standing outside in the cold and having to smoke cigarettes, and they know that they're unhealthy, right? So there's a lot of reasons we know not to smoke cigarettes. That being said, as anyone who has ever smoked a cigarette can tell you, there are some reasons to smoke cigarettes that your brain really likes. Like, for instance, it gives you a burst of energy. It tends to quicken your thinking a little bit, right? In fact, one of the things we know about nicotine is that it can increase over a short period working memory, which is essentially is sort of tied to not only being smart but feeling smart. So nicotine is a stimulant. We like that stimulation. Part of our brain likes that stimulation. And so as a result, there is a genuine reward inherent in smoking cigarettes. Now, you might not like the negatives that come with that reward. You might prefer that the parts of your brain that are more deliberative take over and tell yourself, ignore the fact that nicotine is kind of fun. But there are rewards associated with nicotine that some parts of our brain enjoy, and that's why it's so habit-forming.
Yeah, that's really important, and that there is something you're getting out of it. Now, I just want to go back, because these are, for people who are just hearing about these the first time, these are a little bit tricky, but so I want to just talk a little bit about cues and what they can be, and you say that researchers have found that we have a broad selection of cues. It can be a visual trigger, like the donuts you're talking about, or even a television commercial you see, or a time of day. And we don't really think about that, all the things that trigger us, but understanding that really helps us understand, you know, what's kicking off the habit in us.
Yeah, so almost all cues fall into one of five categories, right? It's usually a time of day, a particular place, a certain emotion, the presence of certain people, or a preceding behavior that's become kind of ritualized. And so usually if you have a habit and you're trying to figure out what's the cue, it's going to be one of those five things. And in fact, it's pretty easy once you start looking at it to figure out what the cue or cues are for a particular habit, right? But if you have an urge for a cookie let's say you have a daily urge for a cookie. If you start paying attention to those five categories whenever you feel the urge, so you sort of jot down what time of day is it, and, you know, what did I just do, and who's standing around me, how am I feeling right now, what you'll realize pretty quickly is that one of those seems to stay consistent from day to day. And in my case, because I had this habit, it was the time of day. The urge would always strike between like 3:15 and 3:45 in the afternoon. And so that's how cues work, is again, your brain kind of latches onto stable patterns that deliver rewards. And the beginning of that stable pattern is the cue. It's the thing that your brain sees or feels that tells it, okay, now's the time to activate habit, 15759 or whatever.
Right. And now the next part of the three-part habit loop, I can't quite speak, is the routine, which is the behavior itself. And you explained that routines can be incredibly simple, incredibly complex, or fantastically simple.
That's right. And many of them are mental routines, right? So when we talk about habits, people tend to think mainly about behaviors. And that's true. A lot of routines are behaviors. And things we don't even really think about sometimes. So for instance, backing your car out of your driveway. The first time you backed your car out of your driveway, you probably really had to concentrate very hard on what you were doing, right? It's actually a kind of complicated activity because you have to look in the mirror and estimate distances and be aware of different things. But after doing it about 5 or 10 times, it becomes habitual. People just kind of do it automatically while still paying attention, but they go a little bit on autopilot. Or, I think everyone has had this experience of you kind of remember walking out the door in the morning and now you're at your desk, but you can't precisely remember how you got from your home to your desk, right? Because you go on autopilot when you're getting onto the freeway or onto the subway. And so those are behaviors that become habitualized through repetition. But there's also mental habits, right? So people who, when they are exposed to a certain situation, they feel automatically an emotion in response that's a habitual response to that particular cue. Or when they when they're trying to work through some kind of problem, or they're confronted with either some type of expression, like they're challenged or they're praised, that they automatically lapse into a mental habit in how they process that information and how they react.
Now, one big secret of habit change is that you can never truly extinguish bad habits. So you say that to change a habit, you have to keep the old cue and deliver the old reward, but you have to insert a new routine. And the routine is the behavior itself. So you have to figure out, you want something, there's something that you are craving. We'll get into cravings, and it's cued by something, that donut box or something, but that you have to change that middle step, the behavior. So tell us a little bit about that, how that works.
Sure. So I should clarify. I mean, there's a lot about this stuff that we don't completely know or understand every facet of it, right? So one of the things we think is that once you develop a neural pathway associated with a particular habit, that it never really goes away completely. And we know that from experiments that would suggest that is true. We might learn more or something different in coming years. But as for now, that seems like a safe bet to say that once a habit is ingrained, that it's very unlikely that the habit ever completely goes away. Now, that doesn't mean you can't extinguish the habit, right? There's plenty of people who have willpower strong enough that they say, I want to give up cigarettes and tomorrow I'm quitting smoking. But two things happen. Number one, that's very cognitively expensive, right? It takes a lot of willpower, and that means you have less willpower for other things in your life. But number two, studies seem to indicate that when people do that, they just try and extinguish a habit, that when they reach a moment of crisis or they're overwhelmed or overloaded, that habit will reemerge, right? That's why people give up cigarettes and then they have like a really bad week, or they have to go spend time with their mother-in-law or something like that, and they start smoking again, is because that habit is still there. They've tried to extinguish it. So what's a much better idea, according to the studies, is what's known as the golden rule of habit change, which you just mentioned, which is that you don't try and extinguish a habit. Instead, what you do is you diagnose the cue and the reward that are driving that behavior, and you try and find a new behavior that's associated with that old cue and deliver something similar to that old reward. And in doing so, you're changing rather than trying to stamp out the neural pathway associated with that pattern.
You know, it's interesting. This is so much like thought suppression research. The late Daniel Wegner did this research where he said to people, don't think of a white bear. And this is unsuccessful because merely by saying that, people would check to see if they were thinking of the white bear, and that was thinking of the white bear. And the answer in that case was not to say, don't do this, but to say, oh, it's hard to not do that, and then to replace the thoughts with other thoughts. So it's interesting to see that parallel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the general idea here is that our neurology sort of abhors a vacuum, right? And that makes sense because from an evolutionary perspective, there's very little that could be accomplished by not thinking about things. And so one of the things that we can do is we can take advantage of our capacity to change what we're thinking about, rather than simply trying to sort of extinguish an earlier thought.
Yeah, and actually Art Markman, who wrote a book on habits also, I'm sure you've read, that he talked about negative habits and how hard they are. To not do something is really hard, and he mentioned that too, that it's really much more successful to replace something you don't want to do with something else rather than trying to just not do it, because our brain's not really, our motivational system isn't really well set up for that, to not do things. It's set up to do things.
Right. That's exactly right.
So I want to talk about craving, because this is a very important part of this. So tell us about Claude Hopkins, who was an ad man in the early 1900s, who actually, we apparently had terrible teeth around then, but he ended up making toothbrushing a national habit. So tell us how.
Well, so Claude Hopkins was this big ad man. In fact, a number of products that we still use today were first popularized by him. And he had this friend who came to him with this toothpaste he had discovered in Arizona that was called Pepsodent. And he wanted Hopkins to sell it. And at first Hopkins said no. And the reason why was because basically no one brushed their teeth in the United States, right? It was seen as this thing that like kind of rich people did. And even then they didn't do it very often. It was just something that like you would do occasionally. And so Hopkins said, look, other people have tried to sell toothpaste. It just hasn't worked. I'm not interested. But the guy said, look, I'll give you a cut of the company if you take this on. So Hopkins said, okay, I'll try. So Hopkins had this basic idea, right, which was he knew that, like, people needed these cues to get them to do things. And he wanted to make toothbrushing into a daily habit because that's where the money really was, in toothpaste. And so he put up all these ads that said,
run your tongue across your teeth, and if you feel a film, then that means that you need to brush, because otherwise your teeth won't be pretty. So the thing is, if you tell people to run their tongue across their teeth, pretty much everyone will run their tongue across their teeth, right? It's sort of automatic when someone tells you to do it. And if you do that and you haven't brushed your teeth, you'll feel this film. It's pretty natural, right? Like, humans have had a film on their teeth for thousands and thousands of years. And that film is actually very, very delicate. So simply, like, running your finger over your teeth or your tongue, or even just, like, vigorously moving water across your teeth, it will cause that film to come away. But Hopkins wanted people to brush their teeth, not to just use their finger or their tongue. And so this is where the kind of incredible part of what he did comes in. He had a cue, right, which is getting people to notice the film that was on their teeth. And he had a behavior that he wanted them to associate with that cue, which is brushing in the morning and in the evening. And he had this toothpaste. And one interesting thing about this toothpaste substitute is the guy who had invented it, almost like kind of randomly, had added these oils into it to give it a minty taste that also contained these irritants that would cause people's gums and tongue to tingle. And so as a result, when people would brush their teeth with Pepsodent, their mouth would kind of tingle afterwards. And what happened was that when Hopkins started advertising his cue and his routine and people started brushing their teeth, they began associating this tingling with the act of brushing. And this tingling kind of became a reward. It would say to people, you've just brushed your teeth, and you should feel good about that because apparently that's something that, like, all of a sudden now we think is a good thing. But more importantly, it actually felt like the toothpaste was working, right? Like, we have this, like, this conception that if something tingles and burns a little bit, that means that it's cleaning up germs. And so once people became used to that reward, then they started brushing on a regular basis. And, like, within a decade, something like, you know, 2/3 of America were brushing their teeth every single day. And if you ask people, if you ask researchers why, they'll tell you it was because of Pepsodent. Because Claude Hopkins had essentially figured out this cue, the film on people's teeth, to make people aware of it, what's known as cue awareness. And the routine, which is taking out a toothbrush and putting toothpaste on it and brushing. And the toothpaste had contained this reward, this tingling sensation that it leaves in your mouth. Now, since then, companies have actually figured out how to create that tingling sensation, and they use chemicals to do it most often rather than oils. But it's the same thing. When you brush your teeth and your gums kind of tingle afterwards, that has nothing to do with making your teeth cleaner. That tingling sensation occurs because there's a chemical in toothpaste that exists just to create the tingling sensation. But it's because marketers and toothpaste sellers know that that becomes a reward, that people begin to crave that sensation. And in fact, you know, when I leave my house in the morning, if I don't have that kind of tingling sensation in my mouth, my mouth feels unclean. I miss it. The same thing happens to be true, by the way, for a shampoo. When you wash your hair with shampoo, it doesn't naturally foam, right? The cleaning agents in shampoo don't create any bubbles. But people need those bubbles. They want to believe that the bubbles are proving to them that the shampoo is working. So shampoo manufacturers add a chemical into shampoo that makes it all bubbly when you rub it in your hair. And as a result, it creates this reward that reminds people to wash their hair.
I particularly like that because actually that lather is really bad for your hair.
But is it?
Yeah, that's what's so funny about that. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is investigative journalist Charles Duhigg, and his book is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. And I want to go under the hood a little bit. You say habits are so powerful because they create neurological cravings. And these cravings emerge so gradually, we're not really even aware they exist. But tell us a little bit about the neurology of this.
We don't know a lot about the neurology of how exactly those cravings emerge. I mean, we know that there's sort of learned behaviors and the parts of the brain that seem to be involved in learned behaviors, but we don't really know a lot about why why some of those learned behaviors feel so insistent and why others don't, why some people are more prone to cravings than others. It's one of the aspects of neurology that I think researchers are trying to understand better, but still have trouble kind of completely understanding outside of a model of learning.
I am reminded of that quote. I forget who said it, but neurons that fire together, wired together, that as you keep doing a behavior, that you are just, it's like you're creating a path in your head, and they just keep going back. You know, you just keep going back, and the path gets more and more worn. I mean, it's very, very interesting. That's why it's so bad, the things people do, especially with their iPhones, and you make a point about checking email. You know, and this is something I've written about in my column. Email is particularly bad because it involves something called intermittent reinforcement. So the reward is only there sometimes, and that really ups people's obsessive need to check the email, and then they check it and check it and check it, and that wears that path into your brain.
That's right. So one of the things that we know is, and a lot of this comes from research from or is being used right now by video games and casinos, is that there's these two kinds of rewards, right? The stable reward that you expect, and then intermittent rewards that kind of catch you off guard. And one of the things, and there's a guy named Wolfram Schwartz who works on this. One of the things that he's found is that our brain, when we anticipate a reward, our brain essentially begins kind of experiencing that reward even before it arrives. This is sometimes called the discounting of reward sensation, that if I know that I'm going to eat a donut, my brain starts anticipating and sort of experiencing the euphoria, for lack of a better word, that will come from the sugar before I even take a bite. And so if I don't take a bite, my brain actually gets disappointed, and a neurological pattern emerges that is associated with depression. And so as a result, that's why I feel this urge to take that bite, is because in part my brain is already anticipating and experiencing the pleasure, but also in part because my brain wants to avoid the disappointment that would come from not having the donut.
I was just going to mention loss aversion. That's particularly salient for us, that we really are upset by loss. So that sort of fits in with that.
Yeah. And so those are stable rewards, right? And stable rewards are absolutely necessary. That's how you form habits, is because your brain expects a reward. But then on top of that, there are these intermittent rewards, rewards that emerge sort of without warning. And the issue for an intermittent reward is that it's like even more powerful for your brain, because your brain has not anticipated and started to offset the pleasure it's going to receive. Right, so if I tell you that I'm going to give you a glass full of juice, and then I give you a glass full of juice, your brain's going to be happy, but it anticipated that happiness. And so as a result, it discounts the pleasure a little bit. But if I don't tell you you're going to get a glass full of juice, if I just all of a sudden give it to you and you drink it down really quickly, your brain doesn't have time to anticipate and discount that pleasure. And so you feel the pleasure much more acutely.
Right. I actually wrote about this in my column. Schultz found that these unpredictable rewards are maybe even three or four times as exciting as expected ones. And this is something that's important for relationships. Sonia Lubomirsky, who studies happiness, she finds that one of the most effective ways to keep a relationship sparky is by injecting surprise, so novel and unexpected things. And I had told people, look, every other week, have a date night, but just you plan it one week, your partner plans it the other, and don't tell them what you're doing. And you can even like go out and have a hot dog on a bench and watch the sunset, but if they don't know, that's that much more exciting, maybe even three or four times more exciting than if they knew that you're going to some fancy restaurant.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of truth in the value of surprise, right? One of the things that we know is that not only does surprise contain kind of rewards by virtue of the surprise, most humans have a desire or a level of pleasure associated with novelty, as well as sensation seeking. And so the more novel an experience, the more surprising it is, in general, the more we'll kind of be delighted by it.
And now you quote these University of Michigan researchers. They said that these particularly strong habits produce these addiction-like reactions, so that wanting evolves into excessive craving, and it can force our brains into autopilot. But you say these cravings don't have complete authority over us, and that we can overpower these habits if we recognize which craving is driving the behavior.
Right. So, the way that this usually comes up is people asking about what's the difference between a habit and an addiction. And the answer is that in many, many settings, there is not a substantial difference, right? If you look at the American Academy of Addiction Specialists, how they define addiction, the definition of addiction relies on and incorporates the language about habit formation. Because what they recognize is that many things that we think of kind of in contemporary conversation as addictions are actually habit dysfunctions. So if you think about gambling, for instance, when someone gambles and they're addicted to gambling, there's no chemical that they're ingesting. It's really a habit dysfunction. Or think about someone who's, you know, given up cigarettes and you know, 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 decades after quitting, they sit down with their morning coffee and they crave a cigarette. If you're craving a cigarette 2 decades after you gave them up, that's not because of an addiction. That's because of a habit that still exists in your brain. And so the takeaway from that is that the first step to changing many of these behaviors that we think of as addictions or that feel like addictions, because addiction lives in the same part of the brain that a habit does, is by recognizing what the habit is, recognizing the cue and reward that's driving that behavior. And once you diagnose them, then you sort of have this opportunity to start shifting it.
Yeah, that's so important. Just to remind people, the cue is the feeling that triggers behavior. The routine is the behavior itself. And the reward is some kind of payoff that tells your brain, yeah, let's do that again. We got something out of that. I wanted to talk about, there was this New Mexico State University study you quote to figure out why people habitually exercise, and it says something about the power of the power of cravings in creating good habits. And you say that many of the people started running or lifting weights maybe on a whim, but that there was a reason they continued, and that's important, why it became a habit.
Or there's some reward that's provided, right?
Right, specific reward that they started to crave, that caused the habit, you said.
Yeah, well, they might not even be aware of the specific reward, right? But we do know that every single habit has a reward. So for some people, it can be that it's oftentimes multiple rewards. So it could be that, for instance, it's the sort of endorphins and endocannabinoids, that runner's high that people get from exercising. Or it could be that they're tracking their mileage and that they feel good about themselves every time they work out, or that they give themselves a smoothie after they go for a run. Basically, the point there is that there are specific rewards for behaviors that our brain latches onto, and that reward becomes part of why we do that thing.
And now Art Markman, who also researches habit, I had him on my show, and he really emphasizes the importance of building the habit into your environment, or your environment into your habit. And you have this great tip along these lines. You say, if you want to start running each morning, it's essentially you choose a simple cue, like always lacing up your sneakers before breakfast or leaving them close to your bed. I mean, that's really a smart piece of advice.
Yeah, if that works for people. I mean, the key here is to sort of experiment with stuff, right? Because I think for some people, if you put your running shoes next to your bed, you see them when you wake up, it's this obvious sort of trigger or reminder to put them on. For other people, they might be able to step over their shoes without really noticing them, or it just doesn't work for them. And so they need some other type of trigger or cue. You can play with different types of things that help you start that behavior, because once you start, it's so much easier to keep going. But the key is to sort of experiment with it. Try different cues, try different rewards until you find something that makes it easier to go for a jog every day.
I found after actually I did the show with him that I was able to take my vitamins. You have to build in something that really works for you. And so I was not taking my vitamin D in the morning. And so what do I do in the morning? The first thing I do when I wake up at 5 in the morning to write is I have coffee. So I started leaving the vitamin D bottle in the coffee jar so I couldn't get to the coffee without taking my vitamins. And what's so remarkable about this is that now I take my vitamins every morning. I don't have to do that. But just from a couple weeks of doing that, of having that annoying thing in there, now it's become a habit. And it's just so cool how that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, our brain just loves to latch onto those things and to make them an automatic pattern.
Yeah, you just have to help it. And now another great piece of advice you give, you advise having a clear reward. You know, so if you're running, your advice was if you're going to do this, you're running every morning, maybe you get a midday treat. So talk about the clear reward.
So, I mean, it's pretty straightforward, right? You have to give yourself a reward and let yourself actually enjoy that reward. So a midday treat wouldn't be a great example of that because there'd be such a time, such a long time between the activity of going jogging and giving yourself a reward in the middle of the day. So one of the things that we know about rewards is that temporal proximity is very, very important. So the faster you give yourself a reward after doing something, the easier it's going to be for your brain to make that as an association between that behavior and the reward. And so, for instance, and people don't have to go running every day to make it into a habit, right? They could run once or twice a week, and you'll develop a habit around it. But the key is that every time you go running, when you come home, give yourself something you actually enjoy and let yourself enjoy it. And now, maybe that's a smoothie. Maybe that's, like, a nice long shower. Maybe you just, like, kind of, like, you know, take 10 minutes and just relax after coming home and sort of feel good about going for a run. You have to give yourself a reward, and you have to let yourself actually enjoy that reward. Now, contrast that with how many people go about starting an exercise routine, which is that you wake up, and you go for a jog in the morning, and then you come home, and you're, like, late, right? Like, so you got to, like, rush to get the kids into the car and to school, and then you're anxious about getting to your desk because you're already 20 minutes late from when you normally get into work. In that case, people are effectively punishing themselves for exercising. And your brain pays attention to that, right? It pays attention to what it gets rewards from and what it gets punishments from. And if you punish yourself because you feel anxious and because you're rushing all of a sudden and you don't have time for a nice long shower, your brain says, look, this running thing, it kind of results in punishment. Maybe I shouldn't make that into a pattern.
I just love that. Now, I want to ask you another question. I'm going to remind people one more time what the cue is of the feeling that triggers behavior. And then the routine is the behavior itself. So you say that, and the reward is the payoff, what you get out of it. So you say that countless studies have shown that a cue and a reward on their own aren't enough for a new habit to last, and you need your brain to start expecting the reward. What does that mean?
Well, so that's what we were talking about before, right? That when your brain anticipates a reward, that's what creates a sense of craving that really sort of propels the habit loop. But that's not a conscious decision you have to make. I mean, your brain does that automatically, right? Anytime you get a kind of stable pattern of rewards, your brain begins anticipating that it's going to come. That's for instance, why people learn to eat fruit, is because your brain learns that, like, every time it picks up an apple and bites into it, that there's this kind of sweet juice and sensation, pleasant sensation that you get from chewing an apple. That's how we learn. It's that sense of expectation is how we learn to basically how to behave.
Yeah, I think what you said, that there's a stable pattern of rewards, that's very important. Our brain likes continuity. So if you always get this thing, there's something very comforting in that to our brains.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it's sort of the linchpin of how all human behavior develops.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Now, you're talking about this thing about getting something instantly, but you quoted this this study. It was from the National Weight Control Registry where people were dieting, and I think you said that 70-some percent were eating breakfast to try to, you know, encourage good habits. But that the most successful ones envisioned a specific reward for sticking with their diet. So they were looking at, oh, a bikini they wanted or a sense of pride they felt when they stepped on the scale each day. Should they have maybe envisioned something that came a little sooner so there wouldn't be that sort of future discounting that you were talking about?
Well, no, because I think that so the reward in that situation is not actually the bikini. It's and the anticipation of the bikini, right? So like if I have a good day and I eat healthily that day, and let's say I'm food journaling, right? Because food journaling is actually, according to the National Weight Loss Register, like the number one behavior that's associated with weight loss is people writing down what they're eating. So let's say that I had a good day and I food journaled really, really well. And I tell myself, well, the reason I'm eating good today is because I want to wear a bathing suit 6 months from now. Well, that reward is pretty far off 6 months from now. But at the end of each day, I'm actually going to feel a sense of, like, kind of pride and accomplishment, right? And that's the reward. The bathing suit's too far off to actually be a reward. But the idea of the bathing suit, the sense of accomplishment on a daily basis and even maybe, like, an hourly basis, that I'm moving closer and closer to a goal that I really want, that's the reward that's changing my behavior.
Yeah, and I like the way you put this in the book. You said that the successful people focused on the craving for the reward. So that's the anticipation you're talking about. But they did that when temptations arose. So focus on that craving, the anticipation. I think that's great advice. And we're almost out of time. I wanted to go to the nail biter because you talk about something called a competing response. This is just great. So tell us about the nail biter and then what her therapist taught her.
Well, so it was this girl who had, like, a really bad nail-biting problem, right? And people who bite their nails a lot, they tend to actually damage not only their fingers but the nerves in their fingers. So it's a real issue. And what he used is this thing called simplified habit reversal therapy. And what they do is they first of all try and teach you to be aware of the cues, cue awareness. So the guy who was treating her, she's called Mandy in the study that he wrote, he told her, every time you feel an urge to bite your nails, just pull out like this note card you should carry around and just make like a little hash mark on the note card. He's trying to get her aware of the cues that trigger the nail biting. And for most people, that the cue is like anxiety or boredom. And then, so she did that for a little while. She became aware of when she was biting her nails. And then he said, okay, now from now on, my guess is that what's going on is that when you bite your nails, that you're overwhelming that boredom or anxiety with sort of a brief physical sensation of pain, right? Because when you bite your nails, you feel that kind of sharp pain as the cuticle pulls away a little bit from the skin underneath, or the nail pulls away from the skin underneath. And that pain, we don't think of pain as a reward, but that pain is actually strong enough neurologically to overwhelm a sensation of boredom or anxiety. And that relieves tension for us. We'd prefer to have pain than the tension of anxiety. And so he said, look, from now on, when you have this urge to bite your nails, instead of biting your nails, just scratch your arm kind of roughly, right? Because we're trying to replicate this intense physical sensation that biting your nails gives you. And that seemed to work. And so what she did is that for the next couple of weeks, she would, you know, scratch her arm whenever she noticed that she had this urge to bite her nails. And that seemed to disrupt the habit enough that eventually it all just kind of faded away and she stopped biting her nails and scratching her arm.
That is amazing. That's remarkable. It's called a competing response. Well, we are out of time. My guest has been Charles Duhigg, best-selling author, investigative journalist, and his book is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. This has, I think, been a very helpful hour. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.